Welcome to the Inquiring Minds podcast. I'm Tom, and joining me today is my co-host, Jen.
Hi everyone. Today, we'll be diving into a fascinating research paper that investigates how Pavlovian cues can lead to suboptimal decision-making. The paper is titled Pavlovian Bias Instigates Suboptimal Choices and was authored by Luigi A.E. Degni, Claudio Danti, Gianluca Fanotti, Sarah Garofalo, and Giuseppe Di Pellegrino.
This paper really gets to the heart of an intriguing question: can environmental cues that we've learned to associate with rewards actually cause us to make poor decisions, even if those decisions go against our best interests? The researchers set out to explore this possibility using a clever experimental design.
That's right, Tom. The researchers used a modified version of the classic Pavlovian to instrumental transfer, PIT, paradigm to examine how Pavlovian cues can influence decision-making. In the first phase of the experiment, participants learned to associate certain fractal images, or conditioned stimuli, CSs, with different food rewards.
The classic Pavlovian conditioning setup, pairing neutral cues with rewarding outcomes to imbue those cues with motivational and predictive power. But the researchers didn't stop there. They then moved on to the instrumental learning phase, where participants had to choose between two different actions, each leading to one of the two equally desirable food rewards.
Exactly. And here's where it gets really interesting. The researchers structured the instrumental learning phase as a stationary foraging task, where one action, the rich option, led to a reward 70% of the time, while the other action, the poor option, only led to a reward 30% of the time. This created an optimal decision-making strategy. Participants should favor the rich option to maximize their overall reward intake.
So the participants had to learn to make the optimal choice, even though both rewards were equally valued. This is a really clever way to test whether Pavlovian cues can actually lead people to make suboptimal decisions that go against their best interests.
Exactly. And that's precisely what the researchers found. When they introduced the Pavlovian cues during the decision-making process in the transfer phases, the participants' choices were biased towards the option that was paired with the same outcome as the Pavlovian cue, even if that meant choosing the poorer option more often.
Wow, that's really fascinating. So the Pavlovian cues were able to override the participants' previously learned optimal decision-making strategy, causing them to make choices that reduced their overall reward intake. This suggests that Pavlovian associations can have a surprisingly powerful influence on our decision-making, even when it's clearly suboptimal.
Absolutely. And what's really remarkable is that this Pavlovian bias persisted even when the participants could see the actual outcomes of their choices in the transfer phase with reward. You'd think that getting direct feedback about the rewards they were earning would have helped them overcome the Pavlovian bias, but nope, they kept making the suboptimal choices.
That's really striking. It almost sounds like the Pavlovian system is just hijacking the decision-making process, overriding the rational, goal-directed behavior that would normally lead to optimal choices. Do the researchers offer any insights into why this Pavlovian bias is so persistent and resistant to change?
They do, actually. The researchers propose that the key factor underlying this maladaptive Pavlovian bias is the value that the cues acquire through their associative learning with the rewards. In a follow-up experiment, they reduced the strength of the cue-reward associations during the Pavlovian learning phase, and found that this was able to abolish the Pavlovian bias during the transfer phase with reward.
I see. So it seems that the more strongly the Pavlovian cues are imbued with predictive and motivational value, the more they can overcome the rational, goal-directed decision-making process. When the cues have less inherent value, their biasing influence is diminished.
Exactly. The researchers argue that this highlights the pivotal role of cue value in driving this kind of Pavlovian bias. It's a really fascinating example of how our automatic, stimulus-driven behavioral tendencies can sometimes override our more deliberative, goal-oriented decision-making.
This has such important implications for understanding and potentially mitigating maladaptive behaviors, like addiction or impulsivity. If we can better understand the mechanisms by which Pavlovian cues hijack our decision-making, we might be able to develop more effective interventions to help people overcome these biases.
Absolutely. The researchers specifically mention that their findings could be relevant for understanding and potentially treating conditions like addiction, eating disorders, and gambling, all of which have been linked to persistent Pavlovian biases that drive harmful, suboptimal behaviors. This is a really promising avenue for future research and clinical applications.
You know, one thing that strikes me about this study is how cleverly the researchers designed the instrumental learning phase to create an optimal decision-making strategy. By making one option clearly superior in terms of reward probability, they were able to really isolate the impact of the Pavlovian cues and show how they can lead to suboptimal choices.
That's a great point, Tom. The fact that the participants had previously learned an optimal strategy, and then the Pavlovian cues caused them to deviate from that strategy, is what really makes this finding so compelling. It shows that these Pavlovian biases aren't just about simple approach or avoidance behaviors, they can actually undermine our higher-order decision-making capabilities.
Absolutely. And I love how the researchers didn't just test this under extinction conditions, where the outcomes weren't presented. They also looked at what happened when the actual rewards were available, which really drives home the point that this Pavlovian bias can persistently lead to suboptimal, real-world consequences.
Definitely, being able to see the direct impact on overall reward intake in the transfer phase with reward is a crucial piece of evidence. It confirms that this Pavlovian bias isn't just a temporary lab effect, but can actually cause lasting detriments to people's decision-making and goal achievement in the face of tangible outcomes.
You know, this study really highlights the complex interplay between our Pavlovian and instrumental learning systems. On one hand, we have this fast, automatic Pavlovian system that attaches value to environmental cues. But on the other hand, we have this more deliberative, goal-directed instrumental system that should, in theory, allow us to make optimal choices.
Exactly. The fascinating thing is that these two systems don't just operate in isolation, they're constantly competing and interacting to shape our behavior. And as this study shows, the Pavlovian system can sometimes overpower the instrumental system, leading us astray even when we know better.
It really underscores how our decision-making isn't always as rational and straightforward as we'd like to think. We like to believe we're making choices based on a cool, calculated assessment of the options. But the reality is that our brains are a messy tangle of automatic, learned associations that can derail our best intentions.
Absolutely. This research is a humbling reminder that we're not always the masters of our own decisions. Our environment and the cues within it can have a surprising amount of influence, hijacking our goal-oriented behavior in ways that aren't always in our best interests. It's a fascinating window into the complex interplay of different learning and decision-making systems in the brain.
Well said, Jen. This study really challenges us to think more deeply about the factors that shape our choices, and how we might be able to better understand and manage those influences. It's the kind of research that not only advances our scientific knowledge, but also has the potential to improve people's lives by helping them overcome maladaptive behavioral tendencies.
Couldn't agree more, Tom. This is the kind of thought-provoking, impactful research that makes me really excited about the field of cognitive neuroscience. By unraveling the mechanisms underlying our decision-making, we can gain crucial insights to help people make healthier, more adaptive choices, even in the face of powerful environmental cues that might otherwise lead them astray. A fascinating study with far-reaching implications.
Absolutely. This is the kind of work that really captures the essence of what we aim to do on Inquiring Minds. Take cutting-edge research and bring it to life in an engaging, accessible way that sparks people's curiosity and leaves them with a deeper understanding of the human mind. Thanks for joining me today, Jen. This was a really insightful discussion.
Thank you, Tom. It was my pleasure. I'm sure our listeners are as fascinated by this research as we are. There's just so much to unpack in terms of how our brains navigate the complex interplay of Pavlovian and instrumental learning, and the real-world implications are incredibly compelling. I can't wait to see what other insights emerge from this line of research.
Me neither. All right, everyone, that's all the time we have for today. Be sure to tune in next week when we'll be exploring another intriguing study that's sure to get those inquiring minds of yours buzzing. Until then, keep questioning, keep learning, and keep being curious about the world around you. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, all. Catch you next time on Inquiring Minds.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Ominous Music Plays.
Are you tired of making suboptimal choices that lead to unsatisfying outcomes? Do Pavlovian cues in your environment constantly lure you away from your goals?
Then you need NeuroHacker, the breakthrough solution that harnesses the power of neuroscience to protect your brain from Pavlovian bias.
Neurohacker uses a cutting-edge blend of nootropics, biofeedback technology, and Pavlovian deconditioning exercises to rewire your neural pathways and fortify your decision-making abilities.
No more succumbing to that irresistible chime of the ice cream truck or the tantalizing scent of freshly baked cookies. Neurohacker gives you the mental armor to overcome even the most persistent Pavlovian temptations.
Experience the freedom of optimal choices. Maximize your rewards. Reclaim control of your brain with Neurohacker. Available now at your local mind enhancement retailer.
Neurohacker outsmart your own biology. Ominous music intensifies, then abruptly cuts out. Hello and welcome to the Cutting Edge Discoveries podcast. I'm Tom, and joining me today is my co-host, Jen.
Hi there, listeners. We're thrilled to dive into an intriguing new study that explores how children and adolescents with autism spectrum disorder, ASD, perceive speech in different types of background noise.
The title of the paper we'll be discussing is Difficulties Perceiving Speech in Non-Social Noise in Children and Adolescents with Autism Spectrum Disorder. It was authored by Yurika Tsuji and Shua Maizumi, and published in a leading psychology journal.
This study is particularly fascinating because it tackles a common challenge faced by individuals with ASD, the ability to hear and understand speech in noisy environments. As we know, sensory processing differences are a core feature of ASD, and auditory difficulties can have a major impact on academic and social functioning.
Exactly. The researchers hypothesized that children and adolescents with ASD would show greater difficulty perceiving speech in noise compared to their neurotypical peers. They also wanted to investigate whether this difficulty would be particularly pronounced in non-vocal or non-social noise, rather than vocal or social noise.
The idea here is that individuals with ASD may have an attentional bias towards non-social stimuli, like environmental sounds, and struggle to focus on the social cues in vocal noise. This could make it especially challenging for them to understand speech when there are non-vocal sounds in the background.
To test their hypotheses, the researchers recruited 48 participants, 23 children and adolescents diagnosed with ASD, and 23 neurotypical controls. They measured the participants' speech perception abilities in both vocal and non-vocal background noise using an adaptive tracking procedure.
The vocal noise they used was a multi-talker babble, while the non-vocal noise was the sound of a water stream. Participants were instructed to ignore the background noise and repeat the target words they heard. The researchers also assessed the participants' speech perception in silence and their preferences for the different types of noise.
Interestingly, the results showed that the ASD group did indeed have greater difficulties perceiving speech in noise overall, compared to the control group. However, contrary to the researchers' hypothesis, this difficulty was not specific to non-vocal noise. Both the ASD and control groups struggled more with the vocal noise compared to the non-vocal noise.
That's a really fascinating finding. It suggests that the speech perception challenges experienced by individuals with ASD may not be directly tied to an attentional bias towards non-social sounds. There must be other factors at play that are contributing to their difficulties in noisy environments.
Exactly. The researchers proposed that the overt instructions to focus on the target speech, rather than the background noise, may have reduced any attentional biases the ASD group may have had towards the non-vocal sounds. They also noted that the ASD group's performance was not explained by differences in speech perception in silence or by preferences or aversions to the noise.
So what does this all mean? Well, the study provides important insights into the nature of speech perception challenges in ASD. It suggests that these difficulties are not solely due to an attentional bias, but may involve more complex processing differences in how individuals with ASD integrate and make sense of auditory information, especially in the presence of background noise.
Absolutely. The researchers emphasize that support is needed to help children and adolescents with ASD overcome these speech perception challenges, as they can have significant impacts on academic performance, social functioning, and overall well-being. Reducing both vocal and non-vocal background noises in learning environments, for example, may be an important step.
And the fact that the speech perception difficulties were not correlated with noise preferences or aversions is also a really important finding. It suggests that these challenges are not simply due to sensory sensitivities, but rather reflect deeper processing differences that need to be better understood and addressed.
Absolutely. This study opens up so many avenues for future research. For example, it would be fascinating to explore which specific acoustic characteristics of non-vocal sounds might capture the attention of individuals with ASD, and how that might impact their ability to focus on speech. There's clearly still a lot to learn about the complex interplay between sensory processing, attention, and speech perception in this population.
Definitely, this is such an important area of study, with real-world implications for supporting the academic and social success of children and adolescents with ASD. The researchers have provided valuable insights, but there's still much more work to be done to fully understand and address these challenges. I'm eager to see where future research in this field takes us.
Me too, Jen. This has been a fascinating deep dive into a really compelling study. I think our listeners have gained some great insights into the complexities of speech perception in ASD, and the ongoing efforts to better support individuals with this condition. Thank you all for tuning in, and we'll see you next time on Cutting Edge Discoveries.
Absolutely, Tom. Thanks for joining us, everyone. Until next time, keep exploring the fascinating world of psychological research with us.
Have you ever struggled to hear your friends or classmates over the chatter and chaos of a busy school cafeteria?
Well, we've got the solution for you. Introducing Noise Be Gone, the revolutionary auditory filter that blocks out all that pesky background noise and lets you focus on the voices that matter.
Developed by the cutting-edge team at ASD Auditory Solutions, Noise Be Gone uses advanced noise cancellation technology to selectively amplify speech signals while dampening non-vocal sounds.
That means no more straining to hear your lab partner during chemistry class, or missing crucial instructions from your teacher in a noisy classroom. Noise Be Gone has got your back.
And the best part? It comes in a sleek, discreet design that fits right in your ear. No more giant, clunky headphones ruining your aesthetic.
So if you're tired of feeling left out and frustrated in social situations, don't wait, get Noise Be Gone today. Visit noisebegone.com to order yours now.
Noise Be Gone, hear what matters.
Whispers batteries not included.
Welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into the latest scientific research and uncover the fascinating stories behind cutting-edge discoveries. I'm Tom, and joining me today is my co-host, Jen.
Hello everyone. Today, we'll be discussing a groundbreaking paper that sheds light on a critical issue facing many people, energy-limiting chronic illness, and its profound impact on employment, social inclusion, and social security. The title of the paper is I Already Have a Job, Getting Through the Day, Energy-Limiting Chronic Illness, ELCI, Social Inclusion, Employment and Social Security.
This paper was authored by Catherine Hale, Steph Benstead, Dr. Kate Hardy, and Dr. Joe Ingold, and it's a must-read for anyone interested in disability, chronic illness, and the challenges faced by those living with debilitating conditions.
The key findings from this research are truly eye-opening. First, the authors establish that people with energy-limiting chronic illness form a distinct subgroup of disabled individuals, whose experiences and needs have been largely overlooked by policymakers and employers. This group faces significant barriers to employment, as well as a social security system that fails to adequately address the unique circumstances.
Absolutely, Jen. The paper delves deep into the lived experiences of individuals with ELCI, painting a vivid picture of the daily struggles they face. We learn that energy impairment, rather than the type of activity, is the primary limitation for this group. Tasks that may seem simple to the able-bodied can completely drain their limited reserves of energy, leaving them unable to engage in paid work or even basic self-care activities.
That's right, Tom. The concept of payback is a key feature of ELCI, where any exertion, even from essential daily tasks, can lead to a severe exacerbation of symptoms and a period of increased incapacity. This unpredictable fluctuation in energy levels makes it incredibly challenging for individuals with ELCI to maintain regular employment.
The research also reveals the profound impact of cognitive dysfunction, or brain fog, on the work capabilities of those with ELCI. Participants describe difficulties with concentration, memory, and decision-making, which can make even simple tasks at work extremely difficult or dangerous.
And it's not just the impairment itself that creates barriers to employment. The paper highlights the structural and systemic issues that further compound the challenges faced by people with ELCI. Rigid work schedules, performance-based management practices, and a lack of understanding from employers all contribute to the exclusion of this group from the workforce.
Absolutely. The researchers found that even when reasonable accommodations were made, the negative attitudes and lack of awareness from colleagues and managers often outweighed any benefits, leading to further isolation and even bullying in the workplace.
The paper also delves into the failings of the social security system, which is supposed to provide a safety net for those unable to work. The authors argue that the current work capability assessment process completely fails to capture the realities of ELCI, focusing instead on outdated and discredited models of disability that dismiss the testimony of those living with chronic illness.
This results in a social security system that is not only ineffective, but actively disabling. Participants described the assessment process as depressing and degrading, and reported that the constant threat of reassessment and benefit sanctions only exacerbated their health issues and feelings of insecurity.
The researchers make a strong case that ELCI should be recognized as a distinct form of disability, with specific adjustments and support mechanisms required to enable the inclusion and participation of this group in both employment and broader society.
Absolutely. The recommendations outlined in this paper are comprehensive and compelling. From employer-led initiatives to improve understanding and create more flexible job opportunities, to a complete overhaul of the social security system to center the lived experiences of those with ELCI, this research provides a clear roadmap for change.
I found this paper to be a powerful and deeply moving exploration of an issue that has long been overlooked. The researchers' commitment to emancipatory disability research, centering the voices of those with lived experience, is truly admirable and lends an authenticity and urgency to their findings.
I agree, Jen. This paper is a wake-up call, not just for policymakers and employers, but for all of us. It challenges us to rethink our assumptions about disability, chronic illness, and the barriers to full social inclusion. The stories and experiences shared by the participants are a stark reminder of the very real human costs of failing to address this critical issue.
Absolutely. This research highlights the importance of listening to and valuing the expertise of those living with ELCI. Only by understanding the nuances of the daily reality can we hope to develop meaningful solutions that truly empower and support this community. It's a powerful call to action that I hope will inspire widespread change.
Yes, Jen, this paper is a must-read for anyone who cares about creating a more inclusive and equitable society. The insights it provides are invaluable, and the researchers' dedication to amplifying the voices of those with ELCI is truly admirable. I'm hopeful that this work will be a catalyst for the kind of systemic change that's needed to ensure that all individuals, regardless of their health status, can fully participate and thrive.
Couldn't agree more, Tom. This is an essential piece of research that deserves widespread attention. By shedding light on the experiences of those with energy-limiting chronic illness, it opens the door to a deeper understanding of disability and chronic illness more broadly. I'm left feeling inspired and hopeful that, with the insights provided here, we can work towards a more inclusive and equitable future for all.
Absolutely, Jen. This podcast has been a powerful exploration of a critical issue, and I'm grateful to the researchers who have put in the hard work to elevate the voices and experiences of those living with ELCI. There's no doubt that this is just the beginning of an important conversation, and I look forward to seeing the positive impact this research will have on the lives of those it seeks to empower.
Well said, Tom. Thank you all for joining us on this journey of discovery. We hope this episode has inspired you to learn more about energy-limiting chronic illness and the vital importance of centering the lived experiences of disabled individuals in the pursuit of a more just and inclusive society. Until next time, keep exploring and stay curious.
Are you tired of the daily grind weighing you down? Struggling to make it through the workday with your energy-limiting chronic illness?
Introducing Spoon Surplus, the revolutionary new service that delivers pre-portioned spoons right to your door.
That's right, folks. At Spoon Surplus, we understand that every daily task can feel like a monumental challenge when you're living with ELCI.
That's why we've developed a cutting-edge algorithm to calculate your precise spoon needs for the day. Just input your symptoms, energy levels, and upcoming obligations, and we'll deliver the perfect amount of spoons to power you through.
No more guessing, no more running out of spoons halfway through the day. Spoon Surplus takes the guesswork out of managing your limited energy reserves.
And the best part, Our spoons are 100% organic, sustainably sourced, and infused with a special blend of vitamins and minerals to give you an extra boost of vitality.
So what are you waiting for? Sign up for Spoon Surplus today and start living your best life, one spoon at a time.
Spoon Surplus, because sometimes, you just need a little extra spoon.
Hello and welcome to the Cutting Edge Research Podcast. I'm Tom, and with me is my co-host, Jen.
Hi everyone. Today we're diving into an intriguing paper that explores the relationship between cities, urbanization, and political change. The paper is titled Cities, Urbanization and Political Change and was written by a team of researchers, Nick Dorwood, Sean Fox, and Christian Hulscher.
This is a really fascinating topic. Cities have long been seen as incubators of democratic impulses and political change, but the authors argue that the story is a bit more complicated than that. They want to tease apart the different ways that population concentration in urban areas can impact politics.
Exactly. The key point is that we need to distinguish between three distinct effects: the spatial context effects of population concentration, the demographic composition effects of who lives in cities, and the scalar effects that come with the sheer size of urban populations.
Right, the authors say we can't just lump all these things together under the banner of urbanization. Let's dive in and explore how each of these factors might shape political attitudes, preferences, and ultimately, political change.
The researchers start by looking at the contextual effects of living in cities. The idea is that the geographic proximity and density of urban areas can facilitate political engagement and activity. You have more opportunities for people to observe elites, exchange information, and coordinate collective action.
But interestingly, the authors say the evidence on whether this actually leads to more pro-democratic attitudes among urban residents is actually quite mixed. Some studies have found urban living is associated with less tolerance and more demand for authoritarian rulers, especially in contexts of high urban disorder.
That's a really important point. Just because cities bring people together doesn't mean they automatically foster democratic values. There are a lot of potential downsides to high population density that could push people towards more authoritarian preferences.
Absolutely. But when it comes to political behavior, the authors are much more confident. They say the evidence is clear that the spatial concentration of people in cities makes it easier for them to actually engage in political activities like protests, petitions, and lobbying.
Right, the contextual effects on behavior seem to be quite strong. Cities provide the physical proximity and coordination that enables collective action, even if they don't necessarily shape political attitudes in a pro-democratic direction.
And then there are the compositional effects. The idea that cities attract and produce more educated, wealthy, and middle-class residents. These demographic characteristics have been consistently linked to pro-democratic preferences.
Exactly. The authors argue that the laws of economic geography mean cities end up with a built-in bias towards populations that are more likely to favor democracy. It's not necessarily something inherent about urban living, but rather the types of people who gravitate towards and thrive in cities.
And the really interesting part is that these compositional effects also have scalar properties. As cities get bigger, they tend to have even more of these wealthier, more educated residents. So the democratic bias associated with urban demographics gets amplified the larger the city.
That's a great point. The size of the urban population, not just the level of urbanization, seems to be a key factor. Bigger cities don't just have more people, they have a higher concentration of the types of people who are more likely to be politically active and support democratic institutions.
Exactly. So when we look at the cross-country evidence, the authors find that urbanization levels alone don't seem to be strongly correlated with democracy. But the size of a country's urban population does appear to be associated with a higher likelihood of both democratic and autocratic political transformations.
Fascinating. So it's not that urbanization automatically leads to democratization, but rather that urban population growth, regardless of the political regime, seems to stir up more political change of any kind, with a slight bias towards democracy due to the composition of urban populations.
Right, the authors are really challenging the simplistic view that urbanization and democracy go hand in hand. It's a much more nuanced story about how population concentration, demographics, and scale all interact in complex ways to shape political outcomes.
And the authors provide an important caveat: even though urban populations may tend to have a democratic bias, that doesn't mean demands for democracy will inevitably triumph. We've seen many cases of urban-based movements leading to a political backlash and a slide towards authoritarianism instead.
Absolutely. The authors emphasize that the relationship between urbanization and political change is full of inherent uncertainty. Urban population growth may fuel more political activity and upheaval, but the ultimate direction of change, towards democracy or autocracy, is highly contingent on the specific context.
That's a really important point. This research doesn't offer a simple formula for predicting how urbanization will shape a country's political trajectory. Instead, it highlights the complex, multifaceted nature of the urban politics relationship and the need for nuanced, context-specific analysis.
Exactly. I think what the authors have done here is pushed us to think more carefully about the mechanisms linking cities, demographics, and political change. It's not just a straightforward story of urbanization driving democratization. There are all sorts of contextual factors and compositional biases at play.
Definitely. This paper is a great example of how high-quality social science research can challenge our intuitive assumptions and push us to develop more sophisticated, evidence-based understandings of important real-world phenomena. It's a really thought-provoking study with important implications.
Absolutely. I think one of the key takeaways is that we can't assume a simple, linear relationship between urbanization and democracy. The politics of urban population growth are complex, and we need to be attentive to the nuances if we want to understand how cities are shaping political change around the world.
Well said. This has been a really engaging discussion, and I think the authors have made a valuable contribution by pushing us to rethink some of the classic assumptions about the urban politics nexus. There's clearly a lot more work to be done in this area, but studies like this one are an important step forward.
Definitely. I'm really glad we had the chance to dive into this paper in depth. It's a great example of the kind of rigorous, innovative research that we aim to unpack on this podcast. Thanks everyone for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
Absolutely, thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with more cutting-edge research that is sure to fascinate and enlighten. Until then, keep exploring the world of science and discovery with us.
Are you tired of living in a boring, politically stagnant city?
Well, have we got the solution for you? Introducing City Growth Accelerator, the one-stop shop for boosting your city's population and catalyzing political change.
With our cutting-edge, patent-pending technology, we can pump up the size and demographics of your urban center, guaranteed to stir up all kinds of political upheaval.
That's right, whether you're looking to spark a democratic revolution or propel your city towards a new era of authoritarian rule, City Growth Accelerator has you covered.
Our team of urban growth specialists will flood your city with educated, middle-class residents, creating the perfect conditions for political unrest and institutional transformation.
Just sit back and watch the protests, petitions, and power struggles unfold as your city's population and demographics rapidly transform. It's political change, supercharged.
So what are you waiting for? Contact City Growth Accelerator today and let us supersize your city and your political future.
Operators are standing by. Call 1-800-URBAN-UPHEAVAL now.
Welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into the most fascinating research papers and bring cutting-edge discoveries to life. I'm Tom, and with me is my co-host, Jen.
Hi everyone. Today, we're excited to discuss a paper that explores a fascinating aspect of speech development in children. The title of the paper is Speech Development Between 30 and 119 Months in Typical Children 3, Interaction Between Speaking Rate and Intelligibility.
This study, conducted by a team of researchers from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the University of Texas at Austin, and the Weissman Center, examines how speaking rate and speech intelligibility are related in typically developing children between the ages of 2.5 and 9.5 years old.
The key finding of this research is that there appears to be a speed accuracy trade-off in children's speech production. In other words, as children speak at faster rates, their speech becomes less intelligible, particularly for longer utterances.
That's really intriguing. Can you tell us more about how the researchers went about investigating this relationship between speaking rate and intelligibility?
Absolutely. The researchers recruited a large community-based sample of 538 typically developing children and collected speech samples from them. These children ranged in age from 30 months to 119 months, or 2.5 years to 9.5 years old.
Wow, that's a broad age range. What kinds of speech samples did the researchers collect?
The children produced a variety of utterances of different lengths, from 3 words up to 7 words. They repeated these utterances as part of a standardized speech assessment called the Test of Children's Speech, or TOCS+.
Okay, so the researchers had the children repeat these utterances, and then what did they do?
The researchers had 2 different adult listeners transcribe each child's speech samples. This allowed them to measure the intelligibility of the children's speech, which they defined as the proportion of words correctly transcribed by the listeners.
I see. And how did they measure the speaking rate?
To measure speaking rate, the researchers used a very precise approach. They force-aligned the speech samples and transcripts using specialized software to identify the start and end of each word and syllable. They then calculated the speaking rate as the number of syllables per second of speaking time.
Ah, I see. So they had both the intelligibility data and the speaking rate data for each child. How did they analyze the relationship between these 2 factors?
The researchers used advanced statistical modeling techniques to disentangle the effects of age, utterance length, and speaking rate on speech intelligibility. They found that intelligibility increased with age, as we might expect, but decreased with longer utterances.
Interesting. So longer utterances were less intelligible, even after accounting for the child's age. What about the relationship with speaking rate?
This is where things get really fascinating. The researchers found that, even after controlling for age and utterance length, there was a negative effect of speaking rate on speech intelligibility. In other words, the faster a child spoke, the less intelligible their speech tended to be. To illustrate this, the researchers estimated that for a 4-year-old child, an increase in speaking rate of just 0.5 syllables per second could lead to a 3 to 5 percentage point decrease in intelligibility for 5 to 7 word utterances.
Wow, that's a pretty substantial effect. So the faster these young children spoke, the more their intelligibility suffered. That really supports the idea of a speed-accuracy trade-off in speech production.
Exactly. And the researchers didn't just look at this at the group level. They also examined the relationship between speaking rate and intelligibility within individual children. They found that for the majority of children, about 75%, there was a negative effect of speaking rate on intelligibility for their individual utterances.
That's remarkable. So this speed-accuracy trade-off seems to be a fundamental characteristic of speech-motor control, even in typical developing children. This suggests that the ability to modulate speaking rate in a way that supports intelligibility is an important skill that develops over time.
Absolutely. The researchers argue that this finding has important implications for clinical practice. If children can be taught to intentionally slow down their speech, it may help improve their intelligibility, especially for those who struggle with speech motor control.
That's a really intriguing possibility. Do the researchers discuss any specific strategies for helping children apply this speed accuracy trade-off to enhance their speech?
They do mention a few ideas. For example, they note that simply instructing a child to speak more slowly may not be enough, as the child would need to have the proper speech motor control to execute that in a way that maintains smooth, natural-sounding speech.
Right, that makes sense. Just slowing down doesn't necessarily guarantee more intelligible speech if the underlying motor coordination isn't there.
Exactly. The researchers suggest that other strategies, like having children practice inserting pauses between words, may be more effective at leveraging the speed-accuracy trade-off to improve intelligibility. But they acknowledge that more research is needed to fully understand the best ways to apply these principles in a clinical setting.
This study really opens up some fascinating avenues for future research on speech motor development in children. By digging into the interplay between speaking rate and intelligibility, it provides important insights into the underlying mechanisms governing children's speech production.
Definitely. I think what's so compelling about this work is the way it bridges the gap between fundamental speech science and real-world clinical applications. Understanding these basic speech motor trade-offs could lead to much more effective interventions for children with speech disorders.
Absolutely. This is the kind of research that has the potential to make a tangible difference in the lives of young children struggling with communication challenges. I'm really excited to see where this line of inquiry goes next.
Me too. This paper is a wonderful example of how rigorous, thoughtful research can shine a light on the complexities of human development and point the way towards innovative solutions. I'm so glad we had the chance to dive into it today.
Agreed. Well, listeners, there you have it. A fascinating exploration of the intricate relationship between speaking rate and speech intelligibility in typical child development. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
See you then.
And now a word from one of our sponsors.
Are you a parent struggling to understand your child's speech, frustrated by the constant need to ask them to repeat themselves? Well, have we got the solution for you?
Introducing Slow-Mo, the revolutionary speech training device that helps kids master the speed-accuracy trade-off for crystal-clear communication.
Slow-Mo uses advanced biofeedback technology to monitor your child's speaking rate and intelligibility in real time. With just a few minutes of daily practice, it trains them to find the sweet spot between speaking quickly and being understood.
The secret? Strategically placed pauses that keep their speech flowing naturally while maximizing clarity. It's like speech therapy, but with a musical twist.
And the best part, Slow-Mo is backed by decades of research from leading universities. So you know you're getting a clinically proven solution to end the guessing game of wait, what did you say?
So why settle for garbled, unintelligible speech? Get Slow-Mo today and unlock your child's true verbal potential. Visit slowmo.com to order now.
Slow-Mo, speaking clearly, made simple.